So I'm here with Loreen at Puscat on Twitter. And so today we're talking about information security, cyber warfare, cyber crime, and sort of an extension of our second episode where we were, talked about those things. So let's start off with, as when we start these conversations, we try to go for theory and sort of definition, and sort of particularly, I'm curious about where do we put the difference between cyber war and cyber crime? So, what is sort of differentiates those two topics?
So it's kind of a funny question from my perspective, because it's kind of like asking the same question, how do we differentiate between war and crime? Right? Like, right. If you went outside and got mugged and they took your credit cards, you wouldn't call it an act of war, right?
Right.
You'd say, I got mugged. But if major infrastructure was destroyed or compromised in some way, you probably call that an act of war, right? And then somewhere in there is espionage, which is not an act of war. If it were an act of war, we'd be at war all the time, right? So I think you probably want to pull it out into three pieces, but if you think about it in the same way you think about regular crime, war, and espionage, it sort of becomes obvious, like, what is your goal, and what kind of actors are acting? And then you can pretty much sort out where it falls in there.
So, I mean, to your point then, you would say that it's more of a, it's less of a theoretical, I mean, is it more of a theoretical divide or practical? I mean, it seems like when we talk about crime, like, to your point, that there's, the focus is different. It's economics, Somebody who mugs you is going for, a wallet, loose change, money. And somebody who's sort of, their emphasis is war, they're going after infrastructure. So now, would that sort of create a more theoretical, or is that more practical, or is it sort of both, in the sense of...
I think it's both, but I also think that apart from just the economic divide, there are ideological reasons to commit a crime also, right? Like, if there's a racist crime, that's not necessarily for monetary gain, right? It's not economic. But at the same time, we can still say that there's a difference between a genocide and a racist crime, right? And then in that case, it's not so much the motivator, but it's the group and their organization and at what level the organization occurs, right?
So you bring up a good sort of good point. Then where do we put the practitioner? How do we define, like, the role of a practitioner of sort of, black hats, white hats, like the general term hacker? I mean, it seems like there's, is the practitioner really a sort of fluid sort of, the skill set is fluid enough to where you could go from crime to war to whatever?
Because I actually don't think that's true. I think if you take a look at crime, what's happening is that you're getting standard practices that have been culled from other people's research. So that you're buying a gun off the street and you're holding somebody up with it, right? What you're not doing is designing a Black Hawk helicopter. And I think my boss, Dave, has a pretty good talk where he challenges the idea that cyber warfare is asymmetric. Now, I don't necessarily agree with his definition of asymmetric, because I still think technically it's asymmetric, but what he's saying is that the smaller player does not have an advantage in cyber war, because cyber war is not about your items, your rootkits, your Trojans, your whatever. Cyber war is about your tool chain. It's about your players, right? It's about the group that you developed to do this work. It's about the maintenance of the work, right? Because the maintenance is far harder than gaining access. Maintaining access is much, much harder.
So then, I'm curious then, where do we put sort of script kiddies? Like, this idea really bothers me because, not bothers me, but it really seems like, when we start theorizing and start thinking about it, from the point of, national security, ethics, whatever, it seems like, when we talk about war, you know, there's the soldier. And when you talk about crime, there's the criminal, right? Mm-hmm. Loosely defined, right?
Yeah.
And then you have, but there's no real, I can't really think of like the equivalent of script kiddies if we were to talk about war.
Or so a script kiddie is...
Oh, first define what a script kiddie is to... Sorry.
It's kind of a misnomer. So anybody that calls their adversary a script kiddie is probably dumber than the person they're talking about. It's actually really hard to be a quote-unquote script kiddie and to do serious work. So if we take that into warfare, those are operators. They're the same type of operators that are kicking in doors and shooting people in the head.
Right.
They just do a different job, right? But a script kiddie is essentially an operator that has no government backing, has no formal training, things like that. But, and this gets into hacktivism, the difference is that how good of a spy master would I be if I developed all these assets for a bunch of years and I was in, you know, ISI, and then when I was really deep in there, I had everybody stand up and be like, haha, we're in.
Right.
Right? That's what defacement is, right? So defacement is useful only if you don't have the capability to act further. So if you have the capability for real espionage, then you're always better off performing it. But if you only have the capability to get in, you don't understand espionage, or you can't perform once you're inside, you can't do the maintenance, which is a lot of work and a lot of money, then the best you can do is work on the publicity angle. It's still worth getting publicity, but it's not nearly as worthwhile as getting real intel, right? And so that's what script kiddies can do. They can get in, and there are certain ways that script kiddies get in that real operators, you know, that they have a much greater capability.
But it almost seems that, to sort of push back on that point, it seems like there's a lot more, I hate using these, it's much more, it's easier to access exploit kits, like, you know, Black Hole, or I'm sure you can name a lot more than I can, but it almost seems that there's a lower barrier to engaging in, you know, not just defacement, but sort of, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, state-driven cyber wars, it's not necessarily, you know, driven by people who are really dedicated to, you know, getting information, you know, stealing information, but it almost seems that the barrier is lower, that you can have a much more, you know, sort of diverse field. And that's where I think, like, a lot of, like, national security people are, like, freak out, because you do have a lot of, just the barrier to just mess with things is a lot lower. I mean, that might not be true, or...
Lower as compared to what? Like, physical access?
Yeah, I mean, think about it, like, in terms of, if you were just to compare, like being a soldier, you know, that role requires what? 9 weeks of training, you know, going through, you know, learning how to use a weapon, learning how to use, you know, tactics, basic, you know, squad tactics. And then sort of we transition that sort of thinking to, you know, cyber, it almost seems like...
Well, your standard script kiddie is going to spend a lot more than 9 weeks learning their trade, right? They're going to spend a lot of years learning their trade. And I think, you know, you talk about those exploit kits, that's... I mean, essentially the tool they're learning to use, right?
Right.
I don't want to say weapon, but it's a tool they're learning to use. It's part of their tradecraft, and they learn it for a long, long time.
Right.
They play around in places that don't have the ability or the care to do attribution. They learn, and then they go after something bigger, right? Now, it's not to say that it is any easier to break into a computer system than it is to break into an office building. I would absolutely not say that. But we have spent so much more time learning how to perform attribution on physical objects than people have learned to perform attribution on electronic objects,
right,
that our police have an advantage there. Now, it is not... I'm not going to say it's significantly harder to perform attribution in cyberspace. It's just that we've spent hundreds of years learning how to fingerprint and tracking people and things like that. We haven't done it in this realm yet. And I also think that, you know, a lot of businesses are not set up to defend themselves properly. And I think a lot of that has to do with probably the security industry, but and the fact that it's expensive and difficult. You know?
So let's sort of switch from... Let's go to So what I'm curious about, where do we place, like, intelligence in this paradigm? Like, and I'm not just talking about sort of it. I'm defining intelligence here as information seeking, defending information, and sort of counterintelligence, which you could say that the corrupting an adversary's ability to seek and understand your information or your operations. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, where do we... I mean, it seems like digital information is so fluid and so, you know, subject to change, and it's, you know, subject to, you know, where do we... How do we understand, like, intelligence, you know, from a cyber perspective?
So, the main areas of my research are in offensive capability. It's offensive research. So, as far as intelligence theory, I might not be the best person to ask about that, but I don't think it, again, I don't think it falls outside of the realm of, you know, being a combination of signals intelligence and human intelligence, right? Now we, you know, have laptops instead of carry briefcases with notes in them, and people tend to use a digital memory instead of their own memory. So perhaps you don't need to do quite so much turning of people to get the information you used to, because they're going to write it down for you somewhere, and then you can access it that way.
Then I'm curious then, sort of, how do we, you know, in terms of theory and in terms of practice, how do we sort of define a system here? I mean, do we just say that really it's just a matter of cryptography? If we just encrypt everything, then that really makes it more difficult to access the information? Or is it, would you sort of integrate more social functions and say, well, it's not just a matter of cryptography, it's also a matter of, you know, being educated on, you know, with social engineering, you know, to basic techniques of social engineering and social hacking?
I think it's neither, actually. I think, I don't think it's social engineering. I mean, to some degree, there's a little bit of social engineering. If I send out 1,000 phishing emails, I will get 10 hits. That's the statistic. Every time we do it, send out 1,000, you get 10 hits. Send out 100, you get one hit. Always.
Wow.
Okay? Every time. That's all you need to do. So there is a little bit of that. But, I mean, you can't expect everybody in your organization to be, you know, a spy, because they're not spies. They are people doing their jobs, if we're talking about a corporation, right?
Right.
So as far as crypto goes, I'm not going to steal your laptop. I'm not going to steal your cell phone, right? I don't care if you lock it up, because sometimes you use it. And I'll be there on your machine when you're using it. And that's how it works, right? So there are some baseline things, like if you... So say we're talking about some quote-unquote script kiddie hacktivists, right? If I encrypt my email between you and I, if they pop a, you know, a SQL injection on a machine that's got our email, and so they're on the machine that's got our email, they can't read that communication.
Right,
so at some level, that sort of thing can help, but they're not going to steal your laptop either, right?
Right.
The only people who are going to steal your laptop are the Mossad, okay? So at some point, it doesn't matter. I mean, maybe you stop them from stealing your laptop, but they probably don't want to do that anyway. What they really want to do is send you a PDF, be on your machine when you're on your machine, and always on your machine when you're on your machine. And then they have access to all your information, because you have to decrypt it to use it.
So how do you build a defense to that? I mean, it seems like the first thing that comes to mind is, well, don't connect to the internet, sort of, you know, what we call air gapping, or, you know, sort of don't connect to the internet and make sure your network is, everything is local, everything is not being connected to the outside. So is that an appropriate defense? And then the next step is, you know, how do we sort of jump the air gap, or how do we sort of exploit that, you know, that adaptation? If we can't.
So I don't think you can give a foolproof defense or 100% defense. What you can do is say, by adding these measures, I am increasing the cost of the operation that is necessary to hit me by X hundreds of thousands of dollars, right? So I think the most expensive change that has been made is ASLR. So I'm not going to get super technical with you, but essentially it moves everything around.
Right.
Okay, so what that means is that you've, in many cases, doubled the cost to attack, because I need two things. I need a tool that will get me access. I need another tool that will tell me where everything has been moved around to.
Hmm.
Okay, so that means if a bug becomes public if it becomes an N-day bug, so it's been out for some number of days, you know, so it's known. If I want to put that in a public exploit pack that I sell, like I want to put it in Metasploit or something like that, it's not going to be useful to anybody. Unless I also put a zero-day bug in there to tell me where things have been moved around to. So we call those bugs info leaks or peaks, right? So I need to, you know, drop a very expensive peak in order to make an N-day bug useful now, right? So if you look at a lot of Metasploit modules or any public releases, you'll see this is an N-day bug, so it's going to hit people who aren't patched, but oh, they also have to have Java 6 installed because Java 6 is not subject to ASLR, so that means we don't need a peak. So they're going to eschew spending that cost for the peak. They're just going to say, oh, there's this other silly requirement, right? And it makes it a lot less useful.
And then what about thumb drives? I mean, that seems, you know, it's, how do we integrate sort of, you know, not just, you know, accessing it through the network or a program, but sort of using thumb drives? I mean, is that a sort of viable tool, or is it more, you know, that's something that's really easily sort of adapted against by saying, don't bring thumb drives into the, you know, into work, into the corporation or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, like...
So this gets kind of into air gap jumping, right?
Right.
So, briefly, air gapping is, you know, not connecting it to a network, keeping separate networks, keeping your machines separate, not transferring between them. And I think actually that's probably your best defense. So like if I were going to defend against, if I were, you know, the head of a investment bank, I would say, here's your computer, you do your work on your computer. It's not connected to the internet, it's connected to our network.
Right.
Right. Here's your iPad. This is where you get outside information. Here is a dumb terminal where you access your email. It is a text terminal. Okay. And none of those ever meet. And if you need to get some files off your computer to email to somebody, you go to the IT guy. He's got the one machine that has a USB drive in it. He will hand you a clean USB drive. You don't give one to him. And then you give it back to him, and he cleans it in another air-gapped network afterwards. Right? So
it's really, like, I don't want to say complicated, but there's a system to it. There's, you know, protocols and rules. Like, if
that would be ideal. I don't think any company would ever let me do that. Right? It would be prohibitive. All of the prima donna traders would get very upset with me.
Right.
Who complain to their boss, and they make the money. I don't. I prevent them from losing the money.
So I think you brought up in sort of the opening, sort of beginning part of the podcast, you brought this interesting idea of symmetry and asymmetry, that really, if I understand it correctly, nobody's really asymmetric, because, you know, everybody's sort of even, because it really...
Well, I've seen two definitions of asymmetric, and I'm sure that you and the rest of your friends could probably go on for 6, 7, 8 hours about the difference between symmetric and asymmetric,
right.
But my understanding of the two thoughts is that, one, we're specifically talking about a guerrilla-style warfare where the smaller player with less resources has some sort of advantage,
right,
using these techniques over a larger player, right? So that's one, but the second idea of asymmetry is that one side is using tactics that the other side is incapable of using or unwilling to use, like putting all of my guys into ambulances, and you're not willing to blow up ambulances. I'm playing an asymmetric game, right? And you're not willing to put guys in your ambulances. So the first degree, where I say the smaller player has advantage, absolutely not. The bigger player with more resources is a much bigger advantage in cyber, okay? However, it's asymmetric in that bigger players can use capabilities that smaller players are not used to dealing with, or aren't capable of dealing with, and are capable of using on their own, right? So, like, if you go to UAE and you sit down with their bank in Abu Dhabi, or you go to the airport and you sit down with those guys and you say, "You guys are owned." What they will say to you is, "It is impossible for us to be owned. We are invincible. You can't own us. Nobody's in our network." And I'll pull up my computer and plug in it and say, "Look, I've got, you know, I see 8 10-year-old worms on your network." And the guy will look you straight in the face and tell you that's not true.
something I'm curious then, sort of about the role of the state then, and sort of, I mean, the state has capabilities and has sort of the ability to, has the money. I mean, let's do this. Where does sort of just this in sheer financial effort, you know, where do we place that in sort of cyber? I mean, the state has the advantage in terms of money and having a base for taxation, assumably. So, I mean, does having a lot of money make a difference? Because, I mean...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For two reasons. So, if we just talk about maintenance, like I get into a system and I'm in somebody's network, I want to be there forever, right? It's not just that I have to get into that network. That costs money. But staying in the network, processing the information in the network, and targeting, picking where to hit next, is incredibly expensive and time-consuming. And it requires a pile of training that your quote-unquote script kiddies don't have. They haven't been trained. People have spent years and years and years thinking about targeting, right? And they're not telling the script kiddies this.
So then I'm curious then, sort of, then moving away from the financial aspect of it into tools. So who has, I mean, that's, I was thinking like, I mean, away from the financial asymmetry of it, but would you sort of argue that, could you say that like, it's really the tools that sort of produce the symmetry between the two sides that really, maybe no.
Absolutely not. I'd say the tools that you see in public are not. I mean, so just think about it this way. Your government has all of the public tools.
Right.
Your public players have none of the government tools.
Makes
right.
Sense.
So if we just look at it like that,
right.
we can say that. And secondarily, we can say that since if there is a market for tools,
right.
what a government is willing to pay for tools is the cost of, you know, how much would you pay to make the lights go out in Abbottabad for 3 hours?
Probably
is
a lot of money.
Is it worth, you know, 12 men, 2 classified Black Hawk helicopters, a smart bomb? Is it worth that much? Because that's what you gain from that. Is, and I'm sure there's an actuarial table somewhere that says how much 12 SEAL Team 6 members' lives are worth, right?
Right.
So it's going to be somewhere in that range that the government sees those tools to be an asset, whereas somebody who is going for economic gain is not going to get that much out of them. They're going to get caught. Because even if they don't get caught performing their action, the FBI will catch them when they try to put the money somewhere, because that's what we're good at doing. We've gone back to our other forensics, right?
So, I mean, you would say that sort of from the perspective of the state that, I can't remember who made this argument, but ultimately, you know, the state might have control, might be able to do sort of, ultimately the state is in control of the law and the enforcement of the law. And really, you know, if they can't, to your point, if they can't, you know, sort of catch you accessing the network or accessing, you know, a corporation, they could definitely catch you when you move the money, or definitely,
yeah.
You know, there's a other potential violations.
The script kiddie is a really good operator, but they're not a really good, money launderer, right?
So then, where does the advantage come in then? I mean, in terms of if we flip it around and say, you know, what advantages does the individual or non-state groups have?
They have the significant advantage that their targets are not government targets. Their targets are, you know, companies that are not used to worrying about state actors attacking them. They're not used to having anybody attack them. I mean, no person, you know, short of living in a war zone, is used to being attacked. That's why we have the government to stop us from getting attacked. And now, you have companies that are directly under attack, and they can't be defended by a government. So now it's on to them, and they're not ready for that. And at the same time, they're still doing the math to decide if it's worth being ready for that. Right? It's like in Fight Club when he says, number of crashes times cost of a settlement times number of likely settlements, how much is that? If it's less than the cost of a recall, who cares? If getting owned is less than the cost of your stock drop, then you write that in the write-off category and you're done, right?
So then, you bring up a really good point then. I mean, it seems that if you develop a target list, if you just sat there and, you know, you were trying to determine what was to be attacked and, you know, how to attack it, you would say that, you know, it's really non-state actors. It's really corporations, you know, and not the government. And sort of, what would be, you know, the gain there? Is it, then it's more economic information, you know, hacktivism? I mean, besides, I mean, strictly from a legal perspective, I mean, is it,
so, I mean,
it really depends on the individual.
Who is attacking the corporations? Is that what you're asking? So, I mean, there are state actors that are attacking these corporations. Obviously, you know, you saw China attacking all of the Fortune 500 companies. Every single one of them got hit, right? So it's 500 companies. And obviously, they're in that case, they're performing espionage, right? They're looking to steal information. So that's one thing. You do have state actors getting companies, but I wouldn't call those state actors script kiddies. When I think of script kiddies, I'm thinking mostly hacktivists, people who are hacking for fun or because they are immature and they think crime is funny, or they have some political agenda, right, that may or may not be coherent, right? So I think your state actors is at a whole different level, right? They have a different toolkit. As far as hacktivists go, they perform pretty much a standard script. Now, the stuff that they are doing is a variation on an attack that was, you know, first talked about in 2001. And in the one paper where it was introduced, all of the research that's ever been done was presented in that single paper. So they're getting in, but you have to think about it like it's not any more rocket science than performing a good, smooth robbery is rocket science, right?
Right.
They're performing a set of rote actions, and nobody's defending against it. It's very hard because there are a whole lot of places to be robbed, and it's expensive to put an armed guard in front of each one, right?
So then, to sort of finish this line of questioning, I'm curious then, how do we create metrics for, you know, how do we measure levels of capability, if we can? I mean, is it even appropriate to sort of measure levels of capability and to sort of, you know, build a rubric or create a metric that sort of sits there and, you know, sort of says, you know, so-and-so is capable of this, this, and this, using, you know, X toolkit? Or is it more, you really have to go from individual case to individual, you know, case and attack?
No, I think we could probably sit down and talk about levels of capability pretty easily, right? We would have our hacktivist level of capability, which is a pretty decent set of social engineering skills, SQL injection and cross-site scripting to attack websites, and some targeted email phishing attacks to get, you know, methods to get in. So you've got just that basic toolkit, and that's pretty much what they use all the time for everything you ever hear about Anonymous doing. I know they also have a DDoS capability, which I don't even consider to be hacking, really.
Right.
It's like yelling. So you have a lot of people yell at once. So then you have another level down where you have the ability to perform some targeted attacks. So like you saw, China's Aurora work was using... it's targeting an old target. It's not an up-to-date target. So they're targeting an IE6, which at the time was old and a pretty soft target, right? But they knew Google was using it, so clearly they had some targeting information that was good. You can tell they have targeting. And they stayed in for a long time, and they egressed information that was useful to them. And presumably they're processing it because they do this all the time, right? And you can say the same thing about Red October, probably Chinese, right? And you can tell that they've been egressing information in a very sophisticated way. So getting in is one thing, and like I said before, if you get in and you stand up and yell, hey, here I am, that's a defacement, you don't have any capability. And that's what you're saying when you stand up and yell.
Right.
I don't have capability, right? If you get in and stay in for 6, 7, 8 years, clearly you have some capability. When you do get caught, we can take a look at what your egress strategy was, and we can see how sophisticated that is. So that's another level, espionage in terms of egress. And then there's another level, right? And that's the Stuxnet level, where we're not saying, hey, we can steal your information. That's obvious. What we're saying is, hey, we can destroy a factory. Any factory we want. whenever we want, we can destroy it. And you won't even know until, you know, you tell your supply chain is screwed, right?
So, that's really interesting because it almost seems, you know, as we move lower on the chain from hacktivism, generic hacktivism, you know, I defaced your website to Stuxnet, it almost seems that the human element is becoming an increased role, is playing an increased role. And I'm not talking about like human, like behind the computer, you know, writing the code for the malware. I'm talking about sort of the more human intelligence that somebody, you know, we go back and examine Stuxnet, somebody had to sit there, had to be in the facility and be in the facility long enough to identify, you know, what system they were using and then be able to transmit that information back. So, I mean, you know, where do we place...
Not even sure that's necessarily true. Oh. Right? So you think about Stuxnet, it was found because it was a worm.
Right.
Okay, why... There's no logical reason for you to have a targeted attack like that where you have so much information where it's a worm. Unless you know something about the network you're attacking.
Okay.
But you don't know where you will ingress, and you don't know where your final target is in your network, right?
Right.
So that seems to mean that whoever came in there and got onto that air gap network, they didn't know they were getting onto that air gap network. Because if they did, they would know where they got in. They wouldn't need a worm. Or they would have access to that network and they could tell us what it looks like. So the only reason it got out is because their air gap wasn't very good, but we didn't know that. Or at some point, while it was air gapped for 5 years, somebody plugged something into it and the worm gets out, right? But the worm is there to find its target.
So I want to, so we've been talking about it, or mentioning it, hacktivism, which is, I don't know how to define this, but it's, you know, really generic, not generic, but sort of, you know, guys defacing websites. I'm using spray paint.
It's a good hand signal, I got it.
Or I'm trying to, so people, right. So, and then sort of, you made the point of mentioning denial of service attacks. You know, the first sort of question I have, is it effective? I mean, is defacement and denial of service attacks, is it really an effective way to make a political point? Or is it, as to your point, mostly shouting, you know?
It's shouting, technically it's shouting, like you're making a lot of noise so that nobody else can get a word in edgewise, right? So that's what it is technically, but I think economically it's very effective. If you shut down Amazon for an hour and a half, how much money do they lose?
Ooh.
Right? So, I mean, it's economically very effective, but you're not going to DDoS Amazon, I promise you that.
Right.
Right? But, I mean, there's one technique where you find an offshore gambling company, and you knock them out and you give them a phone call, and you say, hey, we'll stop knocking you out if you pay us half of what you'll lose. Right? And then they make money that way, because who else are they going to go to? Nobody.
Right.
So that's very effective. I don't think DDoS is effective as a political statement. No one's going to notice if CNN goes down for a half an hour.
No, I mean, like, it's sort of a, there's a, what do you call it, a petition that's basically, I think it's arguing for, I don't know the specifics, but it's arguing that DDoS should be a form of free speech, that it's really, you know, whoever filed this petition with the White House, or I don't remember which, you know, government organization, but it seems like they want to make the argument that DDoS is really a form of political speech, and it's protest specifically.
So if we have a town and there's one well in the town and you and your six brothers stand around it with baseball bats, is that a political statement? Or is that extortion? Right, I mean, like,
right.
You're essentially denying people access to a service. Is that, you know, is that allowed? Can you, if you have a sit-in in front of the town hall, can you block the door?
Right.
Right? Or do people have, you know, can people push their way through? Do you have that right?
Well, I mean, I think the argument they're making is, you know, that it's less extortion, intimidation, and it's more sit-in. Which, I mean, I see it more as, you know, intimidation and sort of extortion more than...
Yeah, like I don't think it counts as a sit-in, because if you perform a sit-in, the point is to be seen so that you have a show of force and to provoke the other side into doing something they'll regret. You want to push them to do something that will make them look bad, that'll turn the tide of public opinion, right? But DDoS isn't going to do that. You standing, you know, you DDoSing a site's not going to get you sprayed with a hose.
Right.
It's not effective in that fashion. So even if they have a claim to say it's free speech, it's not effective, and it is a denial, you know, it's a denial of service. You're just denying people a service, and I don't think that's
that
is free speech at all.
So then why do it? I mean, it just
why do DDoS?
Yeah, I mean, if it's not really effective, and really it's more or less, a form of extortion, then I don't...
Well, it'll certainly cause the person you're DDoSing to freak out.
Right.
It's going to give, you know, the CEO of that company whose website is DDoSed a really bad day. It's going to give them some publicity. It's going to destroy the day of the entire IT staff. It's a powerful action that you can perform, and I think that's why people do it.
Okay. So, is there anything else you want to... I mean, I know that... So I think I've just worked through my questions, my curiosity.
Well, I think you mentioned, do you think defacement is effective?
So,
right?
Right.
And I think defacement is effective in a couple ways. Right. It clearly states that you don't have capability. Right. There's no reason to commit a crime and then say, hey, look at me, I committed a crime.
Right.
which is essentially what you're doing. And what it does get you is publicity, and sometimes publicity is very important, right?
Right.
In the case of Anonymous, it is a flag, right? So it says, this is our target, the target of our ire, everybody who is with us, we hate this. Right? And it's a very public way to do that because it gets into the news. It always gets into the news.
Right. So when
it's essentially they've, you know, drawn a mustache on your poster, but people don't understand the difference.
Well, that's what I'm interested in, you know, in terms of Anonymous, because it really, like, it just strikes me as really, like, sort of almost silly. Like, you know, I think defacement is, you know, it's valuable to draw attention, but it just seems... Like, when somebody defaced sort of the Syrian, their websites, the government websites,
mm-hmm.
I just thought to myself, like, you know, there's other things you could be doing that, you know, it strikes me as very a superficial action, and it's more
about... They could have provided the means of accessing that to somebody who could do something useful with it, or, more likely, the people who do something useful with it already are perfectly aware of that means, and what they've done is... blow up somebody else's operation that was doing something useful.
Right.
Like, somebody else is in there doing useful work, and they came along and said, hey, look, it's easy to get in. So somebody unplugged that computer and went and blew up an operation, you know?
So then I'm curious, then, you really bring up, that was a really interesting point you brought up. I mean, it really seems like there's a potential here for everybody to be at odds, that really, you know, you have... You know, your hacktivists, and then you have your, you know, individuals who are, you know, seeking information, seeking, you know, money, and then you have your state actors. And it really almost seems there's a huge jumble. I mean, I'm just sort of trying to work through, and, you know, especially in terms of Syria, where you have, you know, you have state actors who are interested, and then, you know, non-state, and then hacktivists who are just, you know, really defacing websites for the sake of defacing websites. But
So in... really basic hacking, the very first thing you do when you break into a system is secure it.
Right.
Because you don't want idiots coming in,
right,
doing something dumb, and then having that machine scrutinized, right?
Right.
It's like when people say, oh, you know, there are a million bugs out there, who cares if we, you know, kill this one bug? Well, you found that bug, and you can't do anything with it, so you're going to disclose it and get the publicity. However, somebody who could do something with it may have sunk 8 months of work into making it useful, performed an op with it, and is still in there. And then when you go and blow that bug up, you've destroyed the 8 months of work and the op. Right? Now you have to assume that the person now knows they've been compromised in that way. Right?
But interesting. Crazy stuff. So, is there anything, I mean... I think we've gone for about 40 minutes.
Yeah, I could probably rant for just about ever on all of this stuff.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, I mean, that was definitely an education. Definitely really was good.
Yeah, it was a good time.